This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to New Books Network. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here on New Books History, New Books East European Studies, and New Books Genocide Studies today with my guest, Professor John Paul Himka, who has a new book out. It is called Ukrainian Nationalists and the Holocaust, OUN and UPA's Participation in the Destruction of Ukrainian Jewry. This is just out and published by Ibidim Press, distributed by Columbia University Press as part of its new Ukrainian Voices series 2021. So thank you, Professor Himka, for joining me on the podcast today.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Stephen.
So we have a lot to talk about, and I wanted to introduce John Paul's bio for those in our audience. I think many will be familiar with him and his work over the course of many years, even I think 40 years now. So John Paul Himka received his PhD back in 1977. His dissertation and first book were on the socialist movement in Austrian Galicia in the late 19th century. He followed this up with two other monographs on late 19th century Galicia, one on the spread of the Ukrainian national movement in the villages, and the other on the Greek Catholic Church and the Ukrainian national movement. And then he went off in a different direction. He has another book about this topic by writing a study on the iconography of the Last Judgment in the Carpathian Mountain region from the late 15th through the 18th centuries. After that monograph in 2009, his next major project was on the role of Ukrainian nationalists in the Holocaust, focusing on OUN, known as the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, and its armed force, the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, UPA. Professor Himka had been writing about the Holocaust in Ukraine since 1988. Earlier articles on the topic included a study of anti-Semitism in Krakivsky Visti, wartime newspaper, an overview of Ukrainian collaboration in the Holocaust more generally, and an essay on war criminality as a blind spot in the worldview of the Ukrainian diaspora. So we'll be talking about his book, Ukrainian Nationalists and the Holocaust, which was preceded by a dozen preparatory articles, including one on Lviv pogrom in July 1941. And I should mention, this book, too, was preceded by a book co-edited with Joanna Beata Michlic called Bringing the Dark Past to Light, the Reception of the Holocaust in Post-Communist Europe. So, John Paul, I know I followed your work since I was a grad student in 1999. I remember vividly reading your autobiographical sketch on Icarian flights in many directions. And I'm interested not just in your career as a professor and professor emeritus at the Department of History, Classics, Religion at the University of Alberta, but what motivated you initially into this topic? This seems to be almost like a magnum opus or culmination of a career's work.
Well, I suppose you could go back a long ways, right, to my grandmother telling me about the Jews that she played with as a child, and she was a lamplighter. And then I never knew there was a problem between Ukrainians and Jews until I had a friend, a woman friend in Ann Arbor, and we were hanging out, and her mother came by and said, "Oh, this is odd, a Ukrainian and a Jew together." And I thought, "Why? You know, what's wrong with that?" Well, over time, I learned that there were tensions between the two communities because of World War II. So then I started following things, I would say, more seriously. Well, quite early, really. I followed the topic of anti-Semitism when I was writing my first book on socialism in Galicia when I was doing my dissertation. I didn't hide those aspects. And then in 1988, I got involved in a debate by correspondence with a very close friend of mine, now departed Janusz Radziejowski, a Polish historian, mm-hmm. who said that kind of pro-UPA attitude that I had, which I did have, because that was what I picked up from my milieu. I didn't ever studied it earlier. That this was crazy, that these people were murderers and I shouldn't, there's nothing to admire about them. Well, that set me out to find out what happened. Mm-hmm. And I began doing that with my late father-in-law's archive. He was the editor of Krakowski Wieści, which was a German newspaper under occupation. And I began studying its attitude towards the Jews. And I realized that it published, anti-Semitic articles, sometimes a whole slew of them, during the Holocaust, during the liquidations of the ghettos. And then there's further instances, because in 1995, I think it was, yes, it was 1995, I was invited to contribute to studies in contemporary jewelry about Ukrainian collaboration by Jonathan Frankel, the late Jonathan Frankel. Mm. So mm-hmm. that got me a week to work in Yad Vashem and a week to work in YIVO in New York. And then I wrote that my first kind of researched and thoughtful account of Ukrainian collaboration that came out like later in the 90s. And around that time, I thought maybe I should write a book on the Holocaust. But instead, I decided on the Last Judgment book. I thought, this is all going to go away. Ukraine is now a democratic country. This is not going to be an issue. I finished that book on the Last Judgment icons in 2006. And then I went to Ukraine within weeks of finishing that book, writing the book. And I was about to start thinking about what new topic I should undertake. I thought that the Holocaust was pure history and that other people would do it. Mm-hmm. But when I went to Ukraine in 2006 and I went to Lviv, the capital of Western Ukraine, big billboards commemorating the Nationalist Declaration of the Renewal of Ukrainian Statehood on the 30th of June, 1941. It was an anniversary. Pictures of Shukhevich. Right. I thought, holy cow, don't these people know? Mm. And so I at that time I made my choice. Now I didn't rush into the deep research that I began a little later because I had some administrative responsibilities. I was acting chair of my department, that kind of stuff. But in 2009, I went all out to work on the topic. And in 2010, the president of Ukraine, Viktor Yushchenko, made the OUN leaders heroes. Mm-hmm. He made Bandera, the leader of one of the factions of the OUN, he made him a hero of Ukraine, and he said that streets, parks, schools should be named after OUN and its activists. Well, that then I began trying to warn people, really, that this was not the direction to go in, and I had such a backlash from the community. But then I sort of retired from trying to argue with the community because I saw that the community was not very receptive. And by the community, I will include Ukrainian mainstream sort of institutions of scholarship. And then I just buckled down, did more and more reading, more preparatory articles, because I always like to write articles first, because that's the way I test my ideas. And people say, "Well, that's stupid," and I realize, "Oh yeah, okay, so I'll change." And so then I was working on it, but for a long time I didn't start the actual book. And then we were having a New Year's party. It was going into 2017. And my wife said, "You know, if you really want to do something, you're the kind of person who schedules the time and begins doing it." And I am. I'm a kind of, some people say regimented. I say I have regular habits. And I buckled down, and every day I wrote for at least an hour. And when I had more time, I wrote for more. And, 2019, I spent 3 or 4 years writing. I can't really say exactly. 3 or 4 years writing until I was happy with what I had and sent it off to Ibidem Farag, and they published it. And so here I am, and even being interviewed by New Books.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many things I want to tease out of that story, because I think in many ways you've been arguing against the current, if I can put words in your mouth, of a lot of this institutionalization and nationalization, of course, of political memory since 2004, I think since the Orange Revolution. But I'm really interested in the contents of your book, Professor Himka, to ask you about your source base and how your source base led you to some of the earlier works that were published, some by German historians, some by Polish historians, some by Ukrainian, and some by Jewish historians. So when you went forward, let's say, in this period, when you decided to commit yourself to the project after 2004, what did it lead you back to? I mean, was it John Armstrong? Was it the sort of, consensus about integral nationalism? Was it a lot of fascist literature, history of fascism literature? How did that source base, and we can talk about that, lead you back to the larger problem? And maybe the problem is the problem of Ukrainian nationalism.
The source base that I think, when I began working on it very hard, the source base that probably had the biggest impact on me was a Jewish survivor testimonies and memoirs. And I did a lot of work with them, and I heard what they had to say, and they kind of all told the same story, which is very, very different than anything I had ever heard in Ukrainian historical publications. I was also began reading the trials of convicted murderers or policemen from the Holocaust, and those are the sources that most gripped me and gave me an insight. Then I went back and reread a lot of classics. So, or in my narrow field, classics.
Yeah. What are the classics then for our listeners at New Books Network?
Armstrong's Ukrainian Nationalism was one of them, and I have a whole chapter on historiography.
Right.
So I went back and reread all of Friedman. He was one of the first people to work on Ukrainian Jewish relations and on the destruction of Jews in the Review. Now he's really, thanks to the work of Natalia Alexiun, it's much easier to see him as an important pioneer of Holocaust historiography. And I went back, and I read the works that were published by the working group that was rehabilitating, or Oun en Upa in Ukraine. Their works were very interesting for me because they took a totally different approach than Armstrong or others. They used a lot more Soviet documents, which showed them So, and they were pro-Oun and pro-Upa, but what their documents were revealing was a much more complex picture. I mean, they left out anti-Semitism, they left out the activities of Oun and Upa in the murder of the Jewish population during the Holocaust, but they were, you know, kind of a revelation. I'd had some familiarity with their work, but reading it very carefully gave me a lot of insight. I mean, readers of the book will judge whether I have any insight or not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you would say then, just to pick up on this point, that the source base that enabled you to broaden your perspective would be Jewish testimony, or, because I mean, ultimately, like, you know, we're in the business of turning numbers into names, right? We're talking about somewhere around 1.5 million deaths, right, in this period on the soil and territory of Ukraine. Was it the testimony, like for the Shoah Foundation and things like that, or was it mostly perpetrator documents that you're describing that led you to a reassessment?
I'm talking about the testimonies and memoirs of Jewish survivors. They were probably what gripped me most. And first I went through the testimonies that were collected immediately, actually before the end of World War II and immediately afterwards, by the Zhidovsky Institut Historii, by the Jewish Historical, Central Jewish Historical Commission, later the Jewish Historical Institute. There's about 7,200 of these testimonies. Right. They're very good. There's a nice index by geographical index. They're in Polish, and they're very beautifully constructed. They're not the exact words that were spoken, but rather, I would say, summaries, well-written summaries. Some of them are in Yiddish, and those I had to use translations for. Very much I like the Shoah recordings. What was amazing to me was comparing the testimonies from, like, say, 1946 to testimonies in the 1990s, yeah, and
that's
seeing, you know, the continuity of them. Mm-hmm. And then really helpful to me was my 3 month stay in the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. And they have all kinds of memoirs, survivor memoirs, organized by location. And I just went through every single one of them, you know. And therefore, I had testimonies that came from immediately after the war. You know, some 40 years, 50 years later after the war. And ones that were published all over the world and in small presses, you know, so... You know, some people say, well, the Jews got together and they decided to bash the Ukrainians, because that's the only way that some of the nationalists can explain these memoirs. But the fact of the matter is they never read them. Once you read them, you see that there's a story there that's quite convincing. You know, there's no way people could have agreed on a story, if you know what I mean. These are individuals speaking what they experienced, and when you read them in the hundreds, you get a good picture of what happened. And then, and then much of what they said was corroborated in the trials of some of the perpetrators. So those were important moments for me. Then I read a lot of memoirs by Ukrainians, by members of Oun and Upa.
Mm-hmm.
You have to spend a lot of time reading to write a book like this.
I think of the work of a lot of people in the diaspora, and by diaspora, I don't mean heterogeneous or mono-ethnic, but really mixed in all sorts of different ways in different political directions. And I wanted to ask you some questions about that. So you mentioned a lot of people's work. Homiak family, obviously, Peter Potichny, I would put in the category of people who are writing and also in some ways involved with the history of Oun. But Could you talk about disputed sources a little bit? I mean, you have this, I think, in a couple of your chapters, and especially in chapter 2 on sources. What led you to, you know, sort of investigate stories and sources like Stella Crunsbach, for example, more carefully? And I guess, how did you determine, you know, looking at the work of people like Alexander Motyl or Ksenia Kubyshynsky or Frank Kolchevsky, there are many others I could mention, which sources were dubious, or which, you know, might be considered even fraudulent? How did you go about examining those sources?
Well, I think I take three cases of disputed sources, which I think are the major three disputed sources. And the first one I think I dealt with was the Stetsko. Did I first deal with Stetsko? I don't have the book in front of me for some reason.
Go ahead and introduce the sources.
Well, anyway, so the Crenzbach, this is a memoirs supposedly of a Jewish woman who joined UPA and then later fought for Palestine and became a member who worked in the foreign ministry in Israel and was assassinated. Well, I didn't have to do much investigation on that because the nationalist Bogdan Korduk, who's pretty honest, tried to, he knows the people involved who would have been involved in this region, and they had never heard of Stella Crenzbach. And then Philip Friedman, the pioneer historian of the Holocaust, he did the Israeli side of the story, and no such person was found to have been murdered. And the nationalists, sometimes, you know, when people lie, they lie to a ridiculous point, right? And they were even saying that her memoirs were first published in the Washington Post. And, of course, you can go through the entire Washington Post.
Right.
So, you know, sometimes you have your clumsy liars, and that's the Stella Crenzbach memoirs. But since it speaks to what people want, a fellow like Moisei Fishbein, who's now departed, but he took this and he said, look at how UPA worked with this Jewish woman. And he put it all over his internet page and he promoted it at conferences. But, you know, and Volodymyr Vyatrovich, who wrote a book on Ukrainian Jewish, Oun's attitude towards the Jews, accepted it as real coin. And very often in Ukrainian historiography, you can find that she is the one that's the Jewish memoir that they like to cite. But it was a fake. Mm-hmm. The second one was the Book of Facts. That immediately, the Book of Facts was discovered by the same Volodymyr Vyatrovich who believes in Stella Crenzbach. And he found something called the Book of Facts, which he presented as a chronology of Owen's activities. And in it, there is statements that the Germans tried to get the Oun to engage in pogroms, but they refused to do this, and they warned Ukrainians not to take part. And for that reason, there were no pogroms anyplace in Ukraine, or at least in Western Ukraine, which, of course, is nonsense because there are pogroms all over the place. We have lots of testimony about
the Lviv pogrom.
Oun militias being involved. Yeah. And it was clearly written after the war. So, and by 1943, by October 1943, and actually earlier, they began to realize that they should keep low on the killing of the Jews because the Germans were going to lose the war, and they wanted to make overtures to the Western Allies, which were in the end rather successful. Mm-hmm. And the third case was the disputed autobiography of of Jaroslav Stetsko, the nationalist leader, who said that German methods of extermination should be used in Ukraine and that Jews cannot be assimilated. So this, many nationalists, for instance, Wietrowicz, but many others, have said, well, this is just a Soviet fabrication. But comparing it to an article that Stetsko wrote in 1939, the same phraseology, the same ideas appear, and then there's a number of other points which show that it's clearly a genuine document. So,
right,
you know, if you look at these things, and of course, when something sounds wrong, then you have to look into it a bit. And you know, you might have noticed in my book, for instance, where there's a Jewish testimony and these women talk about the tortures that some of the Jewish victims received. And I say, well, this is unlikely. They didn't see it. You know, they probably, what they are doing is judging by the state of the bodies 2 weeks later in the hot summer and after the dogs got on them. Right. So right. I tried to figure things out.
Yeah. I mean, John Paul, I'm really interested in throughout the book and how, I mean, you as a historian and as a historiographer uncovered the motivations for why particular individuals and historians get wedded, if that's possible to say, to clusters of sources. And I guess I would say beyond that, even to clusters of localities. And that's one of my questions for you, you know, in laying out your chapters, because obviously you're not abiding by the double occupation thesis that so many nationalists seize upon. And even a book like Snyder's Bloodlands is one in which he's not accepting that thesis. But how do you, let's say, get wedded, if one can put it that way, to different areas, regions, towns, maybe even at the village level, because I think it's about scale for you. Can you introduce your reasons why? I mean, for let's say, delving very, very deeply into particular areas. And I ask this as a personal question, too, as someone who translated, you know, histories of some 300 small towns and villages in occupied areas. So what are your regions, let's say, or what are your areas and geographical specifics to places in Ukraine?
Well, since I was working on the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, I concentrated on those places where they were most active, which would have been Galicia, Halychna, Eastern Galicia, or Eastern Little Poland, whatever you want to call it. Yeah, today, the three oblasts of Lviv, Ternopil, and Ivano-Frankivsk. So, mm-hmm. And it became District Galician during the war. And on Volyn, where the nationalists were also very strong. So those would be the main areas I would concentrate. And then northern Bukovina was, for a while, also a place where the nationalists were active. I tried to indicate, you know, their activities in the police forces and civil administrations in the east, where they were not so prominent. Most of the civil administration in Galicia and Volynia, and most of that civil administration was appointed by or sympathetic to OUN. But in, let's say, Kharkiv and other places, there would be just a sprinkling of OUN people in the police. So, and sometimes in the civil administration, sometimes the Nazis would get distrustful of these people and they would kill them. They were profligate killers. So I tried to follow where the action went.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And in the villages too, is there something in particular where you discovered testimonies or evidence to look at the stories in areas which are erased, to borrow, you know, Omer Bartov's phrase? I think you actually have mentions of a few individual places which only
no
have
longer
cemeteries.
Exist.
Would no longer exist, right? I mean, were there some of those that you were drawn to?
I don't have any particular reason why I was drawn to particular places. I rather, as I say, tried to follow the action.
Mm-hmm.
So where the nationalists went, that's where I went.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. And what did they do, you know, in various places where I have information? For instance, you're talking about villages, but I think when I go into the, let's say, the murders of the summer of 1941 that the Ukrainian National Militia committed in Bukovina and Volhynia, which I go into in more depth, they're not always villages. They could be villages, but a lot of them are small towns. What happens in villages, you know, with small Jewish populations? There would be no memoirs from those right. people. There'd be no testimonies. Jared McBride makes this point in his dissertation, which I hope becomes a book before long. That we don't really know what happened in all these places. We know some places because there were some survivors, but you know there could be places where there were no survivors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little about? I'm turning to your arguments now, and some of these you draw upon in your conclusion, but some of the big arguments that you have in the book about Oun and Upa and the relationship. I'm also thinking about the period between August 1943 and July of 1944, with the declarations of equality for national minorities. I don't know if all of our listeners will know this story about the Third Assembly and, you know, the UHVR. What are some of the big arguments about from your findings now in the source base against this current of Oun as national liberators? Could you tell us a little bit?
Okay, let me flesh out a little bit more about about what you're saying. Is that this is defenders of the record of Oun and Upa say that in the summer of 1943, they after encounters with the Soviet population, the pre 1939 Soviet population, they threw off their fascist patina and turned into democratic actors. And this has been latched on onto by I would say most mainstream Ukrainian historians, and it figures very, very prominently in the work of Oleksandr Zaitsev, the historian in Lviv, who otherwise writes really frank and well-researched work on the history of the ideology of Oun. He's very, very good on that. Up till he stops always his research before World War II, and certainly before the invasion of Soviet Ukraine by the Nazis. So, they like this as a way to say, look, they were bad to start with, but they realized and they went on a better path. But the fact of the matter is that in the same period, certainly this is when they are committing the most murders of the Polish population in Volhynia. And it's a period where they are mercilessly tracking down Jews in the forest and murdering them and setting up labor camps for them. Labor camps, and then at the very end of their existence of these labor camps, they killed the inmates. Well, that's not democratic. That's not anything to help the situation of minorities when you kill them. So, as I like to say, and I don't know if I said it in the book, but I've said it elsewhere, I've written it elsewhere, that to take at face value the declarations of August 1943 and July, the dates now escape me.
1944.
To take them at face value, you may as well take the Stalin Constitution at face value, introducing the most democratic country in the world while the terror was raging. You know, so I just think you have to look at context. Official declarations of politicians, even in our age, cannot be taken at face value as to their actions. And in this case, even more so. They were in a situation where the Germans were about to lose the war. They were doing what they could. They didn't want to stop the Germans from fighting the Soviets. They didn't do anything to derail supply trains or anything like that. But they realized the Germans were losing, and they didn't want to make an accommodation with the Soviets because that would not work. So they wanted to appeal to the Western nations, the Western allies. And you even have cases, Jewish memoirs saying that the UPA people, the Banderovce, as they're called, Banderovce, as they're called in the sources, that the UPA people say, listen, America and England has stopped us from killing Jews now. Come join our labor camp. Yeah. You know, so, you have clear evidence that there were orders to kill all Jews and to kill Ukrainians who hid Jews, or anybody who hid Jews, or Poles for that matter. That punishment for that was death. So.
Yeah.
This is aimed at London and Washington. Right.
And are you talking, Jean-Paul, mainly about the documents for the labor camps in this case? Like we're talking like in Volinia, the labor camps in the forest, those sorts of things. Which sources do you have in mind for future researchers to kind of correct the problem?
Well, in the book, I deal with the labor camps. Most of the information comes from Jewish sources, Jewish survivor sources. Of course, some of them were in the labor camps. And in one case, a group of people who worked in a very small camp were saved by a friend they made within UPA, but he said that they had better escape before his friends come and kill them. And others, the Jews who survived, did not enter the labor camps because they heard from local Ukrainians who informed them that all the Jews at the labor camps had been murdered. So, and then we have, though, some kind of interesting corroboration. I cited a memoir by a veteran of the UN, who says that Ivan Litvinchuk, a leader in this area, had set up a number of labor camps where Jews worked, and he's surprised to see that they're not mentioned much in Jewish memoirs, as if you read the Jewish memoirs. But the reason why they were not mentioned much in Jewish survivor memoirs is because none of the people who were in these labor camps survived.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting to me, like to pick up on how you enrich the document collections, because one might think, okay, now that they've been formalized and digitized and produced as giant like sources for a younger generation, that one can just go and read them, and yet you recreate the context. And that's my question for you in dealing not just with the sort of old-fashioned Quellenkritik, but also security service sources. And I'm thinking about the SBU security service of Ukraine sources in Kyiv and how problematic they are and how they need very close inspection. Could you maybe, like, if I formulate this as a way to give advice to younger historians, I'm thinking about the work of Roman Chilaktych or Marta Havrishko or Andrei Usach. How would you, let's say, suggest for a younger generation of Ukrainian and other sort of transnational historians to look at perpetrator documents, not just testimonies, but also the security service sources that are available in places like Kyiv.
Well, I think that, first of all, I have to say that these people do an excellent job. The young historians in Ukraine are, they're better than I am. I want to say that. I have a bigger picture, right? Because I've been in this business longer. But when you look at somebody like Marta Havrysko and her work, it's got everything. She has many more testimonies and many more memoirs. She has personal interviews. She, you know, and she has access to local records, and so do Roman Shlaktych and Andriy Usach. They have access to a lot of material. They know exactly what they're doing. They're they have little to learn from me, is my feeling, except for, as I say, getting that big forest picture. And even then, they'll be correcting it and correcting it and correcting it. My advice to young historians that are not already formulated, people like Radchenko and the ones we've just mentioned, is just to read everything and think critically. Try to figure things out. You know, read everything and try to figure things out.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that there were particular books along the way that prompted you in different directions? I mean, I don't want to just urge you toward name dropping, but there must have been some books like Kai Struva's work or Dieter Pohl, which you read when they first came out and then reread. So could you maybe make some suggestions for those who might be interested in Oun and Upan and Bandera and Stetsko and Shuhevich and Linkovsky and the others? Where would you urge them to start?
Well, I think Struve's book is probably probably the best place to start.
Kai Struve.
His exactly the title is Deutsche Herrschaft. Anyways, it's something like German rule. I have the book on my shelf, but I'm not going to get it right now. German rule, Ukrainian nationalism.
Anti-Yiddish Gewalt, I think.
And
right.
Anti-Jewish violence, yes. That's a really good place to start because he does things correctly. He looks at the evidence from testimonies and memoirs, and he looks at German records, which I don't make as much use of as he does. But on the other hand, I make more use of testimony. And he limits himself to certain testimonies. And certain collections of testimony, mainly the ones from the Jewish Historical Commission, and he uses the Soviet documents, and he puts them all together to try to tell the story. He thinks about what could have happened and what couldn't have happened. Let's say how many people could have been killed. He's a conservative estimator. I think if I were to take a model book, I would take that. Kai Struve is a very interesting writer. The funny thing is, we've been working on similar themes by accident over the years. So
right.
I wrote a book called Galician Villagers and the Ukrainian National Movement. It's a good book, I think. It has little problems with it. But then he writes this brilliant book called Bauern und Nation about Polish and Ukrainian peasantry and the national movements of both and how they extrude the Jews from this process of national awakening. I think Struve is one of my favorite historians, really. And I would say, yeah, so read that. You got to know languages to do this. You got to know German.
Sure.
You got to know Russian, Ukrainian, and Polish.
Plus Yiddish and Hebrew, right? Or at least have translated.
It would be very good to know Yiddish and Hebrew. I had used Yiddish for earlier work I did, but I didn't revive it for for this book because I had so many sources already. And plus, I had a lot of help from others who gave me Polish or Ukrainian or Russian translations of some of the Hebrew and Yiddish testimonies. You know, I'm particularly grateful to Mikhailo Tyakhly in Kyiv, who would send me translations of things because he was working on the Roma Holocaust. And some of the same perpetrators were involved.
I guess, the fact that you mentioned Struva is fascinating to me. It was one of the books that Omar Bartov gave me to read. So I think about the new directions that you mentioned. And I want to ask, sort of some final questions about Ukraine for you. So we have Vyatrovich, whom you mentioned, who's no longer in charge as of 2019. And there's a new director. And I think for anyone who is concerned with, let's say, civic space and civic patriotism and civic nationalism and holding these conversations on a couple of different levels, whether it's Vergangenheitsbewältigung or property restitution, I'm interested in what you might see as possible in Ukraine in the 2020s, given all the oligarchic space, but what conversations might you imagine a younger group doing this research holding in this, now 2020s, in this coming decade?
Well, there's a strong resistance in Ukraine to any Holocaust research that includes the activities of the nationalists. So the state generally tries to promote narratives in which the nationalist factor in the Holocaust is played down. And there are Jewish organizations and leading Jewish figures that go along with this. So Yosef Zisels and his Association of Ukrainian Jewry thinks that all mention of nationalist perpetration is basically a Kremlin plot. And Anatoly Podolsky, who heads the leading Center for Holocaust Studies in Kyiv, he also does not want to deal with nationalist perpetration. These things, and I've talked to other Jewish scholars on the Holocaust who live in Ukraine, and they say things like, "Well, we don't want to insult or we have to respect the sensitivities of our Ukrainian colleagues." Mm-hmm. I've heard that. On the other hand, these Ukrainian scholars, like the Usaches and Havrishkos, etc., they don't have that same kind of, they're not Jews talking about how evil the Ukrainians are. And by the way, nobody's saying Ukrainians are evil, none of these intelligent people. They're just looking at what happened. Some people were involved in some Ukrainians were involved, particularly the nationalists, but others were involved in the persecution of the Jews. It was actually something that happened, just like it happened in many other countries. So the kind of pushback they would get would be pretty terrible. I know that they have, let me now just pretend that there's some kind of generic thing and that there are not individuals involved. But I know that people have been persecuted at their jobs or lost their jobs for taking a critical position on the nationalists. And the a big center where this kind of research can be freely done is the Center for Urban History of Central Europe in Lviv. Mm-hmm. But that has foreign funding. I mean, Harold Binger has generously supported that institution. They built it from the very scratch, and it is a place where critical history can be done. You can't get real critical history at the Ukrainian Catholic University. You can't find it in the National Universities in Lviv and Kyiv. The Academy of Sciences steps back on this issue as well. But there are little pockets. A lot of these young scholars, and Radchenko in Kharkiv set up his own little institute, and he's well treated there. And he's a really nice guy, and he's one of these people who don't annoy others like I sometimes do. He's easy to get along with, and he's got a little place. But very much their position depends on help from abroad. They need the scholarships, fellowships at the Holocaust Museum in Washington and at Yad Vashem and in other places. This gives them access to sources they would not be able to get in Ukraine, and also exposure to the wider scholarship on the Holocaust, and they make friends among the wider circle of students of the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. So I think that they're going to get pushback. A big case is the Babi Yar Memorial. Mm-hmm.
In the news again. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where there are two camps. And one of those camps has a real history of the Holocaust and the other doesn't. But one has some funding from Russians and the other doesn't. You know, I'm hoping that the book contributes to some people's rethinking this. I mean, the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies, the Harvard Ukrainian Research Institute, they were inviting the Vyatroviches and giving them kind of academic credentials and partnerships with that. And maybe when a larger group in East European studies and in Holocaust studies gets the picture of what was happening, maybe they'll be a little bit less reticent. I mean, they have to bow to their donors, so they can't really promote this kind of thing.
Right. Well, I'm glad for your honesty here in talking about questions which have larger implications, not just in Ukrainian-relations or Ukrainian-Jewish relations, but also Russian-Ukrainian relations. This issue of platforming and deplatforming and funding and defunding, I think these conversations have been held in private for many, many years, but not so much in public. And I'm hoping that can be aired. My last question for you is just a simple one, since we've been talking about Ukrainian nationalists and the Holocaust, your book. If you could talk a little about your other book and maybe your current research interests or things that you're working on for our listeners here at New Books Network.
Okay. Just maybe weeks or around the same time that the book on the Holocaust was released, I was co-editor with Franz Szabo of a book on Eastern Christians in the Habsburg Monarchy, which was published by CIUS Press. That's Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies Press. And, Franz is one of the leading historians of the Habsburg monarchy. What we were working on was a book that we didn't write much ourselves. We wrote the introduction, we put it together. But it's an attempt to be a bit of a corrective in Austrian studies and studies of the monarchy, Habsburg monarchy, in that we've taken... not a single crown land, not a viewpoint from Vienna or Budapest, but we've looked at a group that constituted, a significant proportion of the population throughout the monarchy, and tried to show that the Eastern Christian component was both ran across crown lands of Austria, and was a significant cultural component of the monarchy's culture. And Eastern Christians, we try to show that this kind of Western extension of orthodoxy and Uniatism provided some very interesting hybrid cultures. And we have excellent authors. I mean, Bob Magoci wrote a long introduction about the about all the Eastern Christians in the monarchy, and we have I don't want to go through it. I've done a whole interview on this.
People are going to have to read the book, I'm afraid, right? And listen to your other interview.
But and then what I'm working on now is actually I'm in a period of kind of suspended animation here. I'm trying to figure out what to do next.
I'm sure you're going to be working on something. So thank you for that. You have two books out simultaneously, so it's almost unfair to ask you about what you're working on night and day. But I congratulate you, Professor Himka, on both. And I really wanted just to say thank you for your time and for all of your work and for promoting scholars too, who really started from zero and began reading about you and your life and past and identities and how you came to all of these things, both personally and professionally. So I thank you for that.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Stephen, for having me on the program. I think it's wonderful that you do this work.
And I'm Stephen Siegel here at New Books Network. We've been speaking with historian and Professor John Paul Himka at the University of Alberta in Canada, now Professor Emeritus. His new book is called Ukrainian Nationalists and the Holocaust, Oun and Upa's Participation in the Destruction of Ukrainian Jewry. This is published by Ibidem Press, distributed by Columbia University Press as part of its Ukrainian Voices series, new series, published 2021. Thanks so much again to John Paul and to all of our listeners for being here with us on the podcast today. Until next time.